The book of Habakkuk, when we first started doing this, I anticipated it only taking us maybe a month or two. And I'm not sure how long we've been here now, but it's been a while. We're in the final chapter, and the whole final chapter is basically a prayer that is spoken by Habakkuk the prophet, that it seems as though it was intended to be music added to it, so it was something that was to be sung and repeated, not only by Habakkuk, but by other people as well. And we kind of challenged ourselves last week with the idea that prayer really is a form of worship, but we don't really think too much about it as being a form of worship. We think more about it as a time of asking God to do things. And I did give you homework last week, and the homework was to try to pray some this week without even asking God for anything. Did you do it? And how was it? Was it a good experience? And we just remember this. Petitions are good, but they can't be the parcel of all of it, right? Well, we're going to pick up with verse 3. So let me read verses 3 through 7. God came from Teman, even the Holy One from Mount Paran. Selah, his exalt, which means he's exalted or lifted up. He covered the heavens with his glory, and the earth is filled with his praise. His brightness or his radiance is like the sunrise, rays flash from his hands, the hiding place of his power, pestilence or plagues go forth before him, and firebolts come after him. He stood and shook the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled, and the age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. I saw the tents of Cushan in distress, the dwellings of Midian in anguish. I would imagine that as we've read through there, some of you are probably going, gosh, what am I supposed to get out of that? What does that have to say to me? Well, I hope that by the end of the next 30 minutes or so that we will have maybe some answers to that question. Remember, we ended last week with these words, in wrath, remember mercy, right? And we talked about how we ourselves are a perfect example of wrath with mercy, understanding that Jesus took God's wrath on our behalf, that we would be granted the mercy of God. This part of the prayer does exactly the same thing that we were talking about in Sunday school this morning. It brings to remembrance particular things that God has done, particular ways and events in which God has displayed his glory and his power and his might before the people of Israel in the past. So let's consider verse 3. God came from Teman, even the Holy One, from Mount Paran, Selah. He covered the heavens with his glory, and the earth is filled with his praise. Now, I would imagine, sometimes I think maybe we need to have a course here in geography of the Old Testament, right? Or the ancient Near East, so that people will have a better idea of, you know, where some of these places are. I would imagine there's very few people in this room that have any idea where Paran is or Teman either, right? Not common names that are used today. But both of them refer to, there was a wilderness just south of the Promised Land. It's the wilderness that Israel went through for those 40 years. It would include Mount Sinai and the Sinai Peninsula and the desert of Sinai. Paran and Teman are in that area. So it's good reason to believe that what's being here is acknowledged being here is reference to the things that took place with Israel in Sinai. At Sinai, God manifests himself in very magnificent ways. We might have the idea that it would have been really cool to be there at Mount Sinai when God descended on the mountain, when he gave those commandments and all the rest of the Mosaic law to Israel. We might think it was the greatest, most wonderful worship experience that the people of Israel ever had. But when you read the scriptures, guys, that's not the impression you get. What you get is that it terrified the people. This manifestation of God, as the mountain shook violently, as smoke descended upon the mountain, as the trumpets blasted. What did the people have to say about it? They came to Moses. He said, "This, please don't let God speak to us any longer. You go and you listen to what he has to say, and then you come and tell us." We need to understand this. There's times when God appears, he's not this jovial Santa Claus kind of guy. When there's a sense of his power and his might that frightens people. One of the points I would imagine that Habakkuk is trying to drive home at this point is this, is God is unchanging. We talked about this a lot last week. That as Habakkuk is prophesying and he's ministering in his day, many, many centuries after that, God hasn't changed one iota. You can't say that for Israel, however. Israel is in bad shape. While there certainly are some there who are still following and worshiping and walking with the true and living God, there were many there, if not most, who had drifted a long, 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 long way from him. Israel's become increasingly wicked and evil. And one of the things that we always have to remember is this, is did God make himself known to everybody in the world to the same degree and in the same ways that he did Israel? No. Do we believe for a minute that God has revealed himself and made himself known equally to everyone that has ever breathed air? The answer to that is no, too. Now, as we've prayed this morning, you need to understand something, and that is God has made himself known to all people through his creation. Paul talks about this very much in Romans 1. This is what we call general or universal revelation. In other words, God has made, there's no one that can say that they didn't know there are gods, what it's going to come to. That no one's going to have that excuse when the end comes. Just what the Bible declares is just by creation, that's enough right there to convince every person that God is. As they look upon creation, nature around them. But it's not sufficient to bring anyone to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. We have to have something in addition to it. And that's what we call special revelation. The Bible. People that have that available to them are not rendered less accountable. They're rendered more accountable. In other words, yes, the Babylonians were wicked, awful, terrible people like we've seen here pictured by Habakkuk. But at the same time, we understand that Judah fell into that same category. And there was a sense in which Judah was accountable to God in a sense that Babylon wasn't. In other words, as much as your knowledge and understanding of things increases, your responsibility increases with it. He covered the heavens with his glory, and the earth is filled with his praise. Now, you and I live on the other side of the coming of Jesus Christ, right? And we understand how a lot of these things that we're reading here are more greatly fulfilled in him, right? I mean, for instance, on the night that Jesus was born, a multitude of heavenly hosts appeared to the shepherds, saying, "Glory to God in the highest, on earth peace among men with whom he is pleased." That was a fulfillment of God filling the heavens with his glory. But we understand it's not the whole part and parcel. We understand that Jesus is coming again, and that is going to be the epitome of God filling the heavens, the sky, with his glory. At that time, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. Then all the tribes of the earth will rejoice, celebrate, mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with what? With power and great glory. See, we live in the now, but not yet. In other words, some things that Christ has fulfilled, he's fulfilled. But there's still a lot more coming, right? Verse 4, his brightness or radiance is like the sunrise. Rays flash from his hand, the hiding place of his power. I shared with you not too long ago, I used to surf. I know Lloyd used to surf too. And he did it before I did because he's older than me. But my buddies and I, we always went to Daytona, actually upon San Luis, which is a little south of that's where we usually went surfing. But very often we'd leave early enough in the morning that we could be there at daybreak. Or sometimes we'd drive over the night before and we'd sleep on the beach. So we'd see the sunrise. And there's just something about a sunrise that really is like the glory of God filling the sky, right? You know, when you get to that twilight thing where it's been really dark and maybe this moon's not even out, so it's very pitch dark and you can see so many stars, and the more you look, the more stars there seems to be. But then twilight comes, where the sun's light's beginning to break into the sky again, but we can't actually see the sun yet. But then the body of the sun begins to rise above the horizon, and light bursts forth. His brightness is like that. Need to understand something. This is a metaphor, and it's probably not even a great metaphor. Because there's nothing quite like the brilliance or the radiance of God. In other words, what we understand, anything that we can come up with, we think maybe it's a picture of it, it falls far short of what reality is. Sometimes the radiance is used as a synonym for the glory of God, and sometimes it's used as a symbol for knowledge in the Bible. But it always has to do with enlightening. A place where there was not light, now there is light. Again, God manifesting himself in ways that his presence, his existence can't be denied. God doesn't have hands. Jesus tells us in John chapter 4 that God is spirit. So you need to understand that any time in the Psalms or in the prophets or any place else in the Bible where it talks about the hands of God, it doesn't mean literal hands. That's what's called an anthropomorphism. In other words, we're taking something, a piece of anatomy that people have and likening something God has to that. But you need to understand that's all it is. That God literally doesn't have hands because he's spirit. Now, Jesus has hands because he is not only God, he's also man, right? But what we're seeing here is this is basically God's power being contained by his clenched fist. In other words, God's fist is holding his power back. And every now and then, he cracks his fingers a little bit, and his power flows forth a little bit. Very often, the power of God is likened to be a consuming fire. In other words, where we are right now, if God opened that fist, his power would immediately consume every wicked, every evil, every wrong, every bad thing in all of his creation immediately. That one of the things that's going on right now is God is restraining that. He's holding it in. He's holding it back. But on the day of the Lord, his fist is going to be wide open. And he will be a consuming fire. He will restrain his wrath, his anger, no more. Before him goes pestilence, and plagues come after him. Firebolts. When we say pestilence, we know it's a bad thing, right? Plagues are bad things. And just remembering, part of what's going on here is there's a reminding of the prophet to those who are listening of the past acts of God in their history. So it would behoove us to understand this, that probably what's most on mind here is this, is God's deliverance of Israel from Egypt. How did he do it? Through pestilence and plagues upon the Egyptians. First he turned the water to blood. Then he brought up the frogs. Now, I was cleaning out our swimming pool yesterday. And Lauren and I actually drained it down months ago because we just didn't really bother with it through the wintertime, and we had some algae problems and like that. We were putting chemicals in it. They weren't doing anything. We said, we're just going to drain it down and let it sit here for months empty. But, you know, swimming pools don't sit empty very easily, especially in Florida where it rains. So we had some water coming and going, and when you bring water in there, then you wind up with frogs. But I don't think there's anything that smells worse than a decaying frog. Because one of the things about getting a swim pool, once they get in there, they're stuck there. And if they can't get whatever they need to eat or whatever there, guess what happens to them? They die. Can you imagine a country covered with frogs, but then a country covered with frogs that are dead and decaying? Gnats up your nose, in your eyes, in your ears. I don't think we really have gnats much anymore. When I was a kid, I remember we had gnats all the time, and they were doing that. They're flying up your nose and in your ears and in your eyes. It was not unusual to get a gnat in your eye. Don't see gnats like we used to. Flies on everything. So you might have a fly swatter anymore. Some of you probably do. We don't see many flies around our house. But I can remember a time when everybody had fly swatters. One of the reasons is because everybody's doors were open and their windows were open because it was so blasted hot. And we used to eat in a picnic table in the backyard because it was warmer in the middle in July in the backyard than it was inside our house. There were always flies to contend with. Death of the livestock, boils on the Egyptians. And you understand that there's a turning in all of this where Israel actually suffered through the beginning of those right along with the Egyptians. But eventually these plagues began to make a distinction between Israel and between Egypt. And the Egyptians suffer these plagues, but the Israelites are protected from them. Hailstones, locusts, darkness over the land. Death of the firstborn of every household. Serious business going on there, right? I used to wonder this. Why in the world did God let Israel go through those first plagues right along with the Egyptians? I think it was for a lot of reasons, but one of those reasons that we would understand, and maybe they would understand, that they were not innocent in all this either. Maybe God gave them a test of what they really deserved. A taste. What do you think about that? Well, we know this. We know that every one of these was a form of God's judgment upon pagan idol worship and all that stuff. That Israel did too. Not just the Egyptians. When Israel came out of Egypt, they brought the Egyptian pagan idols right along with them. Israel, guys, a clear example of, instead of wrath, people getting mercy. I mean, wrath, ultimately, the wrath of God is what every single person deserves. Everybody. Doesn't it give you a great deal of comfort in understanding that Jesus endured the wrath of God for you so you don't have to? Do Christians still suffer in this world? The people who are Christians, they suffer sometime in this world because they're Christians? Yes. Sometimes we suffer and we don't stop to think for 1 minute that it might have something to do with our sinning. Have you got a speeding ticket lately because you were actually speeding? Have you completely lost it with somebody? We understand this. That Jesus has saved us. And he's not only saved us from our past sins, he's also saved us for our today's sins and our future sins. And if that were not true, we would be sinking ships. You understand something? Every form of human suffering has something to do with sin. The fact there is suffering in this world is evidence that sin is in this world. The fact that we still suffer in our lives is that there's still sin in us. Because God is a just God. Egypt received God's wrath. Israel, on the other hand, received God's mercy. For one reason. Because God says, I will be gracious to whom I'll be gracious, and I'll be merciful to whom I will be merciful. In other words, it's not something that we can ever demand of God, because if we demand it of God and he's obligated to give it, then we're earning something. Mercy is something that must be freely granted and freely given. At this point, the prayer shifts from Israel to more of a general sense to the nations of the world. He stood and shook the earth, or it can't mean he stood and surveyed the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled and the age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. There's no place in Scripture that it ever depicts God as standing on his throne. He's always sitting. Even when you bring Jesus in the picture, Psalm 110, verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, do what? Sit at my right hand. In other words, the normal posture we see God described as being in is he's in his throne room, on his throne is sitting. When I was reading this, I thought about Stephen, the first deacon, one of the first deacons. He was marred for his faith. And what the scriptures tell us was this. What he did was, guess what he did, is he went back and he recounted all the great works of God for Israel down through the history of that nation, to demonstrate how faithful God had been over and over again and how faithless Israel had been. And we're told there that when they heard these things, they were enraged. But he, Stephen, full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. So Jesus isn't sitting, he's standing up. So what's the big deal about that? What does it take, if you're sitting down, to get you to stand up immediately? Something's got your attention. No matter what it is, it may be something that's immediately got your attention, just like whammo bammo, and you want to look and see what's going on. You understand that Jesus stood up watching what was going on with Stephen? That had his undivided attention at that moment? How many of you have experienced earthquakes? Some here have, some have not. Let me tell you, I've been in two of them. One of them was pretty serious. The other one was not much. And let me tell you, and I was always with other people. I was never by myself. And let me tell you, I don't remember anybody saying, you know what, God, this is really cool. Gosh, this is fun. Gosh, I wish it wouldn't stop. I wish this would just keep going on and on and on. Talk about terror. Talk about afraid. I'm not sure anything is going to make you and I more terrified or afraid than a blasted earthquake, because we have absolutely no control whatsoever over it, and there's nothing we can do about it. We can't alleviate it anyway. And it demonstrates to us the power of God in a way that very few other things can. When the earth itself shakes. Things like that are nothing for him. We know this. We know that earthquakes are strong enough to cause mountains to collapse. How many things do you know can take mountains and make them into dust? Name them for me. maybe a nuclear warhead. Earthquakes, volcanoes, etc. The power of God. In other words, he cracked a little space between his two fingers. Could be another thing that's being alluded to here, because very often ancient cities were built on mountains or on hills because they were more easily defended. You know, you've heard the rule of thumb when it comes to the military. You want the higher ground, right? It's easier to defend the higher ground than it is the low ground. And one of the things that might be in the thought here is this, is all these kingdoms that we've talked about, and all these ancient cities built on mountains. The Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans and all those other nations that have at one time had great power, but when God has entered into the picture, pow, what happens to them? Completely collapse. I mean, where's the Roman Empire today? Where's the Babylonian Empire today? Where's the Greek Empire today? They ceased to be in history a long time ago. You understand that sometimes when you go and you share Jesus with people that they're going to just think it's great and wonderful, and other times they're going to spit fire in your face. You understand that? It's just a measure of the darkness and the blindness of the human heart. But does God have the ability to overcome that? You betcha. Remember when Rahab in the Promised Land had that conversation with the spies that Joshua sent into the land? What she said was this, is, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and then all the inhabitants of the land melt before you. Do we ever consider the fact that God can do that as we're going out and sharing the gospel with other people? God's ways don't change. God's ways are eternal. He's doing everything today just like he has in the past and just like he will do in the distant future. That can't be said about anything else. Everything else changes. God is the only thing that is that foundation, that solid rock foundation that cannot be shaken, cannot be moved, cannot be destroyed, cannot. His ways are eternal. Verse 7, there's some conversation about what a cushion really is. Midian, we know a little bit more about from the Bible. This is in verse 7. I saw the tents of Cushan in distress, the dwellings of Midian in anguish. We know that Moses had a Cushite wife, and we know that they were kind of a nomadic tribe that lived kind of in the area that we were talking about as far as Paran and Teman goes. The same thing is true of Midian. And we do know that Gideon delivered Israel from the hand of the Midianites, right? Remember that from Judges? Kingdoms and empires come and go. Peoples come and go. Tribes come and go. Nations come and go. Is there anything that's eternal? What about the Church of Jesus Christ? Now, it did have a beginning. Will the church falter and fail? Will the church collapse? Will the church just fall to the dust and then some other thing come in its place? How many kingdoms do you know of that lasted for 2,000 years? Or maybe 10,000 years? There are none. We live in a time of lots of unknowns. You and I wonder what tomorrow's going to be like. We wonder what life for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren are going to be like. We wonder if anyone with any sense is going to get enough power to get this whole boat going back in the right direction. We wonder about this and we wonder about that. But there's some things we don't have to wonder about. And one of those is the Church of Jesus Christ. It may weaken at times. It may not be as crystal clear at times in history as it is at other times. But it will not fail. It cannot fail. It won't fail. How can we say that? Because God promised that. That even if the gates of Hades come against it, the church will endure always. So you and I need to think more on the eternal scale. We're still wrapped up in this time thing here. Time for you and I is no longer measured in seconds and hours and minutes and weeks and months and years and things like that, millennia. You and I live in the scale of eternity. That is our time scale. Okay, this week's homework. I want you to pray a prayer of worship. But began to ask for a few things, a few petitions. Okay? Try it. Next week we will move on.